Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. It's lunchtime. Is your stomach growling? It's a lovely day to head into the woods or even your backyard and find something to eat. Today we're talking about foraging, gathering food from the outdoors. The practice is, of course, as old as the human race. Many of us have picked blackberries or even dandelion greens without calling it foraging. Still, most people these days don't know their mullein from their mayapple. That may be changing. Foraging is experiencing a renaissance. Some of the fanciest restaurants in the world are known for their wild ingredients. At Noma in Denmark, which has been called the best restaurant in the world, patrons pay dear for dishes with ingredients like moss and pollen vinaigrette. But you don't need to shell out $200 for a taste of the outdoors. You just need to know what you're doing. Aspiring foragers often get their start by going out with someone who knows the ropes. And in Maryland, that person is pretty easy to find. Organizations ranging from the University of Maryland Agricultural Extension to the Parks and People Foundation have offered foraging workshops. There are foraging walks and even cooking classes where you can learn how to prepare your finds. Today, two experienced foragers have joined us in studio to give us an introduction, and they have brought some wonderful foraged foods with them. Nick Spiro is a biologist and longtime forager who teaches courses on wild edibles for the Natural History Society of Maryland. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you.
And Eric Kelly is the founder of Charm City Farms, an urban agriculture initiative that teaches self-sufficiency skills, including foraging. He also founded a group called Foragers of Baltimore. So glad you could join us.
Thank you.
Nick Spiro, let me ask why. Why do you forage for food?
I foraged pretty much from the time I can remember being a child. It was just something that was fun to do.
Where? Yeah. I mean,
My father bought a farm in central Pennsylvania, so it was a wonderful place to spend time. And I actually learned from people that it wasn't a trendy thing to do. It was a necessity. I learned from people that had to forage in order to feed themselves.
Your father immigrated from Greece, is that right?
My father was born in Sparta, yes.
But you're talking, so you learned foraging from him, but also from people
also from
with
a community.
Deeper roots in Pennsylvania.
Absolutely, yes.
And Eric Kelly, how did you get hooked on foraging?
When I was younger, I was a ridge runner at Oregon Ridge, and Kirk Dreher, the naturalist there at the time, introduced me to my first wild plant. And from there, I was pretty hooked.
It sounds like you may have a memory of that first wild plant.
Oh, I remember
it
specifically. He picked it up, said, "This was wood sorrel. You can eat it." I ate it, and I was like, wow, there's more of this? There's more stuff I can learn like this. So I was hooked from then on. Took a pretty big gap.
And you were about how old at that point?
13.
So how did you pursue that as a teenager?
I really didn't as a teenager. I got back to it in my late 20s, really, really hard by taking about 6 pounds of field guides on the Appalachian Trail and really digging into it. I brought a couple of field guides here.
Yeah, I see them stacked up here. I wish our listeners could see this table, which is normally just home to bunch of papers and some pens. It's got all kinds of green things growing on it. And so I guess I should, maybe this is the right time to ask you, Nick, just tell me what you have
brought. Last night I actually went out and got some cattails to show you the different parts of the plant. Most people, and when Andrea interviewed me, she said, "You mean the part that looks like
Andrea
a
Appleton,
corn?"
Andrea Appleton, our producer.
Exactly. Yeah. The part that looks like a corn dog, and I kind of laughed because that's what she's talking about.
That's exactly what
So this is the part that most people never see. This is the male part of the plant.
Wait a minute. People can't see it. We're on
exactly.
The radio. So you're pointing to the top part that sticks out. It's still a very vertical thing, but it's sticking out of the brown, fuzzy corn dog part of the plant. And that, you say, is the male part of the plant.
That's the male part of the plant. And when the sheath is still on, this part can be steamed and eaten. It's quite good.
So before it gets fuzzy, it's got a green. It looks really very much like a stalk of corn. It's got vertical leaves that fold around it the same way leaves fold around an ear of corn.
Exactly. And when it opens up, you see the dust coming out of there? That's pollen. So I collected this last night. That's cattail pollen. Very high in protein.
He is pointing to a jar that has what I would say is the equivalent of a cup and a half of mustard-colored powder. How long did it take to collect that?
Maybe half an hour.
So you shook that out of the tops of a bunch of cattails.
That's correct.
Where were you doing this? Where these cattails were growing?
In a marsh.
In a marsh.
Eric's laughing because neither one will probably disclose locations. I'll take people out and show them areas, but some areas are on private property, and I would be persona non grata if I told you where that was.
Okay, since you have raised it, Eric, let me ask you also, what rules govern where you can forage for food?
I have several rules that
I
tell
people.
I asked
the question to Eric. He just ducked and passed it back to Nick.
There's responsible foraging, which, number one, you need to positively identify the plants that you're going to eat. You need to be responsible and respectful to the plants. If you're digging up roots, you're going to kill that plant. So make sure that there's a sustainable amount of plants there that can handle you taking some of the plants. Plants are animals. Plants are living things. So if you listen real close, when you pull plants, you might hear, Be respectful when you collect plants. Don't collect in parks. Don't collect in people's yards unless you have permission. It takes an effort to find areas where you can responsibly collect.
Eric, where do you suggest that people go to collect, to forage?
Make friends with landowners. I just ducked out of that one, too. I mean, there's a lot of places. You know, if we were to forage a meal, it really doesn't take that much disturbance of an ecosystem to do that. So, you know, I do it, Nick does it here and there. It actually probably helps the ecosystem more than anything else because we're distributing seeds and other things. But I can't tell you. I mean, there's legalities. Like, you can't take plants. You can't even take rocks from state parks. So you can't forage there legally. I think you can forage mushrooms.
Depending upon the ranger.
Yeah, I want to ask you when we're going to talk about safety later, and I certainly want to ask you about mushrooms at that point. But would people in a city or a close-in suburb who have, you know, a quarter acre, a little plot of land, would they be likely to be able to forage in their own yard?
Oh, absolutely.
Stuff that they had thought was a weed that turns out to be food?
Some of the stuff I brought in here is plant, is medicine and food that can be found in a lot of
your... Give me an example.
Well, we have plantain salve here that...
I'm sorry, plantain?
Plantain salve.
Salve?
Yeah.
It's this green... It's a jar of... A relatively small jar of green something.
She's going to smell it.
Smells fine. Yeah. It's kind of an avocado green, and it looks very waxy.
It's emulsified in beeswax. And,
I see. So the texture of it is the beeswax.
Right. And my son actually recently stepped on a nail, and I used that to extract any particulates that would have been left in there. You can use it for bee stings. You can use it for splinters, shrapnel, any number of things.
So plantain salve. So the plantain is, I think of as like a banana, a hardier
right.
version of a banana.
You're probably familiar with this little silica husk, though, that sticks
out. I have no idea what that is. He's showing me a stalk that has, it actually reminds me a bit of the cattail we were talking about a minute ago, but it's much smaller. It's a vertical, it's an up and down fuzzy looking thing with some flowers sticking out of the very top. What is that?
This is the silica husk from the plantain plant. This is from common plantain or narrow leaf plantain. But I should back up for just a second while it's on my mind. A great place to forage, I think, is organic farm. Because organic farms have weeds and, of course, are very shrewd about their soil and what they do and do not spray. I got a lot of this from my urban farm right down the street here, which, of course, the soil has been tested, and I know kind of what's around the area. But, yeah, anyone's front yard can supply. So this is red clover that I brought here.
And that is a jar that looks like the clover flowers that you're used to seeing, big pink ones, mm-hmm. Round clover flowers. What do you do with clover flowers?
It smells a little greeny, but This actually has a proven...
It smells...
Dare I say.
Smells like a kind of tea. And I guess you could probably make tea.
Yeah, this you would use this for a tea, and it has cancer preventative constituents in it. That's actually been proven by science, not just me saying it. So I feel like this is a very important one, and especially in the community that I am, well, all around us.
I'm sorry. You think that the clover...
Red clover.
Harvesting the red clover blossoms is especially important in the community we live because...
Cancer is all over the place.
And you think this is a cancer preventive?
Oh, yeah. It's documented and proven that it's preventative medicine. A lot of the herbal medicine, I feel, is it's not... it's preventative, you know. Just a tea is very easy to add to your, you know, daily life for cancer prevention or for any other common ailment you may be have in your family, gout even, whatever.
That is Eric Kelly, the founder of Charm City Farms, an urban agriculture initiative in Baltimore, here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also here in the studio is Nick Spiro. And am I pronouncing that right?
That's correct.
Nick Spiro, a biologist and longtime forager who teaches courses on wild edibles for the Natural History Society of Maryland. We're talking, as you can hear, about foraging. They've brought me quite a few foraged foods and medicines that we're going to be talking about. And you can be part of this conversation. Are you interested in foraging? Are you looking for tips? Or does the whole thing make you a little bit nervous? You can phone us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email, midday@wypr.org. What else have you brought? What is this big... these big leaves here.
This is spice bush. This is another plant that's available. If you just crunch that up a little bit more, you'll smell it in a minute.
Yeah, I'm looking at leaves that are, help me describe, these are...
They're simple leaves. The margin is entire.
They're...
do you smell it?
Wonderful, I do.
Wonderful fragrance. A tea can be made from this. There are red berries that are ripe in the fall. The berries can be made into... there's medicinal value to the berries, but they can also be used in a rub for meat. Very common plant.
It's so common that I mean, I wouldn't look twice at it. As I said, the leaves, the biggest leaves, the presumably the mature leaves, are 4 or 5 inches long. They're oval in shape. They've got, you know, a rib running up the middle of the leaf and some ribs branching out. And I have no idea how I would remember how this
is a very small tree
compared to any other plant.
Very small tree that I'm sure you've encountered in just about every forest that you've walked into, Lock Raven, Liberty, Pretty Boy. It's a small tree, maybe 10 feet tall, probably no bigger than 2 or 3 inches
in diameter.
So this
is actually going to, I'm going to see these leaves on a tree, not sprouting directly out of the ground. They're
going to
be on with a trunk.
That's correct.
A tree with a trunk.
So Eric mentioned finding things in our organic garden. These came out of my garden. I actually encourage weeds in my garden. This is wood sorrel. If you just try that, taste buds will jump. Okay, take some leaves.
I will in just a minute. We need to take a break, and I'm going to tell you. I'm holding a little stalk of a bunch of small leaves.
They almost look like clovers.
And they're heart-shaped. They're like clovers. And heart-shaped. I'm going to taste it while we take this break, and you're going to wish that that you were here with us in the studio. But almost as good. You can join us by phone. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org as we continue our conversation after the break about foraging, how to find food in the forest. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. We're talking today about foraging, the hunt for edible plants, berries, and fungi. My guests are Nick Spiro, a biologist and longtime forager, and Eric Kelly, founder of Charm City Farms and the Foragers of Baltimore. You can be part of this conversation. What would you like to know about foraging? Give us a call at 410-662-8780. Send an email to midday@wypr.org. So I tasted this plant that hooked Eric Kelly on foraging, and it really has quite a I can't even describe the flavor. It's a little bit lemony, and there's something else in there. But I had to really chew to get to it. Nick?
That's exactly right. I'll hand things to people in the field, and like most modern people, they just chew it up and swallow it, and, oh, there's no taste. The taste on most wild edibles are very subtle, and I'll tell them, try it again, chew it slowly, and savor it. And then all of a sudden, oh, yeah, I get it. So wild edibles, as well as all food, be thankful, chew it slowly, and enjoy it.
Yeah, we've probably all been told that 100 times, but edibles kind of enforce it. You're not going to enjoy them as much. We have a call from we had a caller who asked, things that look like wild strawberries that grow in your lawn, are those edible? She's not with us anymore, so I can't. I'm not sure I'm picturing. There are wild strawberries, right?
Yes, there are.
There could be wild strawberries. There could be the Indian strawberries that you can eat them. They don't taste like very much of anything. They're just a blast of liquid, pretty much, when you put it in your mouth. But you can eat them. They're edible.
Okay.
They're not going to hurt you.
getting back to the, is it sorrel or sorrel? I've always called it sorrel.
Tomato, tomato.
Okay. The sorrel that I'm holding in my hand, what, aside from just chewing it and having my taste buds light up the way Eric said it did for him, what would I do with this? It would be good in a salad?
Absolutely. All of these plants that I have here that are actually weeds from my garden that I encourage to grow all make a great salad.
So tell us about some of the other ones that you're pointing
this
to.
This is lamb's quarter, chenopodium. It's a powerhouse. The flavor is incredible. Tastes better than spinach to me.
Is this called lamb's? This is
lamb's
called quarters, lamb's quarter?
Chenopodium.
Okay, these, I'm looking at, these are kind of.
Goosefoot is the common name. So if you look close, it looks like a goose's foot.
The leaf looks kind of like the shape of a webbed goose foot. It's kind of roughly triangular, but it's got some extra shape, and it's got ragged edges. And let me taste a tiny one.
If you like spinach, you'll love this one.
Is it similar to spinach in the sense that there's a different flavor that comes when you cook it? Because I got to tell you, I'm not getting much flavor out of just the raw.
I like it raw.
You like it raw?
I have never cooked lamb's quarter.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, so you must have better developed taste buds than I do. Mm-hmm. Eric, you're about to say something.
I have cooked it, and it's you could use that any way that you would use cooked spinach, like in a quiche or just as a pot herb. Or it's cousin to the quinoa, too, so you can process.
It's a cousin to quinoa?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So you can use the seeds the same way. Difficult to process, but yeah.
Huh.
This plant will get over 6 feet tall in your garden, and it'll have seed heads. As Eric said, hard to process. If you take a sharp pencil and make a dot on the paper, that's the size of the seeds.
Yeah, that would be hard to catch.
They're prolific, but it still takes an effort.
And if you have that, and you just pop off the tops right around now, it'll continue to grow and grow and grow all summer.
So this is lamb's quarter we're talking about.
That's right.
Or goosefoot.
Right.
You can keep it just growing and growing. Mm-hmm. Okay, I can see it in a salad, but I would need some salad dressing on it, I think. What is this that you just handed me?
This is purslane. This is another one that grows wild in the garden that I watch people weed their garden, and I laugh. This is something that in high-end health food stores, you're going to pay money for this. It's almost like a succulent. Mm-hmm. It tastes phenomenal. This one, you have no problem tasting the flavor on that.
I will taste it, but the texture strikes me actually more than the mm-hmm. taste. It's another mild taste, but if I were to have encountered this without your guidance, I would look at the kind of silvery underside of the leaf, and I would think, oh, there's something that's something on that. That's I shouldn't be eating that because it's probably contaminated in some way.
I have a 7-year-old grandson that's quite a forager, and he'll tell you the number one rule of foraging is to positively identify a plant before you eat it. So if you don't know, knowledge is key.
Okay, but how do you get from where I am to where you
come
are in terms
of
knowledge?
Exactly. I've been.
What, I didn't hear what you said.
Come hang out with one of us.
You know, both of us give information because we both love this so much. We want others to enjoy it the way that we do. I've been doing it for over 50 years. I had a group
you started
out
as a very small child.
Yeah, exactly. I had a group out, and we probably showed people 60 plants. There was a 20-something-year-old that was shaking his head. He was overwhelmed. At the end of it, he said, "This is too much." And I looked at him. I said, "Explain." He said, "I can't remember 60 plants." I said, "I didn't learn 60 plants overnight." I said, "Learn 3 plants this year. Learn them throughout the year. Look at plants that are persistent, like milkweed, like cattail, and pick another one. You pick one. And learn 3 more next year." He looked at me, and a light bulb went off. He says, "Oh, this is doable. You're not going to learn what Eric and I know overnight. We've both been doing it for a long time."
You really have been. Let's talk to Ed in Lutherville. Ed, welcome to Midday.
Hello. Actually, your guest just mentioned purslane. I have about 2,000 square feet of vegetable garden that's all about 3 years old, and I'm working with some organic farmers at Moon Valley Farm in Cockeysville, and they keep pointing out to me all the weeds that I'm pulling, and purslane is one of them. And the more I weed that garden, the more purslane I get. And I've just discovered that, in fact, it's edible. One of my neighbors loves the stuff. And we're having actually, I hadn't even thought about this till just now. We're having a home and garden tours at our state-of-the-art, sustainable, and accessible home this weekend. I can email that to you, and if you want to put it on your website, that would be great. If not, that's fine, too. But there's another weed, and I don't know what it's called, but it's very wispy, and it has little tiny yellow flowers on it. My organic farmers actually pick that and eat it, too, and I forget what it's called. Maybe one of your guests does.
So you're looking, Ed. You're looking you're hoping they can identify a wispy weed with yellow flowers.
It has little tiny yellow flowers on it, and the flowers actually have a flavor for them that I don't know that I can really describe, but it's a clear flavor.
Nick,
we just talked about this. This is wood sorrel. The flowers, the seed pods, and the leaves all contain oxalic acid. And when you chew it, it tastes lemony. And that's another wild edible that is actually in your garden.
But I would not call this wispy. I'm not sure we're talking about Ed's plant.
I bet it is.
There's
in
another,
the garden.
There's another plant that has small yellow flowers that somebody thought was that the sweet clover that gets a little bit taller.
Yes.
And has small yellow flowers.
Ed, do the leaves almost look like four-leaf clovers?
No, actually.
I would not call this wispy. I think Ed has another. I mean, wispy.
Ed,
wispy
run on
with
down.
Yellow flowers.
Bring it down. We'll identify it for you.
Ed, I appreciate your calling. We're talking about foraging in this hour. We're talking with Eric Kelly and Nick Spiro. And you, some of you have called in. More of you can 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@WYPR here on Midday on WYPR. Antonia has called us from Parkville. Antonia, welcome to Midday.
Thank you so much. A very interesting program. My grandmother grew up in a small village in Greece, and when she came to the United States, she would have my mother drive all over town, stop at on highways, go into fields, and pick these amazing greens that we would eat later that night. I really wish that knowledge had been passed down to me, but since it hasn't, is there any way there's a class I could take? Because as wonderful as these descriptions are, it would be so much more effective if somebody could point it out to me. Yes, this is edible, and this is what this looks like. I would love to dedicate time to learn more about it, and is there a resource for me?
Antonia, thanks for the call. I think both of my guests probably have lots to suggest. Nick's eyes, Nick's Greek eyes have gotten very big. So,
Andrea, I know that plant very well.
Antonia,
I know that plant extremely well. It's Amaranthus. It's probably, I'd have to check on a species, but this is a plant that Greeks eat everywhere. In Greece, here, my father was a big fan of that, and most people think it's a weed. It's an amaranth plant. It tastes wonderful. I offer classes at the Natural History Society, plant identification, wild edibles. Check us out. Look at our website. Check us out.
So we will put a link to your website
on
our website. Eric, what would you say to Antonia?
We have, at Charm City Farms, we have 2 to 3 plant walks a month. We also do mushroom identification. We had a medicinal mushroom workshop this past weekend. We have a mushroom and plant walk this coming Sunday before our fundraiser.
We'll talk about that before the hour is out. So Antonia, and we will obviously link to Charm City Farms also. So Antonia, if you check our website in a couple of hours, you'll have some suggestions for how you can actually take some classes and see these plants. Antonia, I appreciate your calling. Jennifer has called us from Baltimore with a bone to pick with you, Eric. Jennifer, welcome to Midday. Jennifer?
Yeah, hi, sorry. I have an issue with you as a host for not sticking to the point and asking more questions about the statement that red clover is a cancer preventative. That's not science. That would have been worldwide jaw-dropping news if that were a true scientific statement, because cancer is everywhere, and if there was something so simple as red clover tea that could prevent it, it wouldn't be like a secret that nobody knew. So I feel like you're doing a disservice by making that statement, and that's kind of like a snake oil charlatan type road that I don't think you should be going down.
Jennifer, I appreciate the call, and I understand you're saying your issue is with me, not with Eric. I think I took preventive not as a firm promise that you would not develop cancer, but that it was something that would tend to reduce your likelihood. Eric is looking at his medicinal plants and herbs book, The Peterson Field Guide, and he's going to, I think, share with us what he says is the scientific background for that statement. Eric?
This book is very brief, and it's not going to go in detail, but I should mention that the author, Jim Duke, worked for the USDA for a very, very long time and retired early so that he could write another book, The Green Pharmacy, which speaks in depth about herbal medicine. I don't know if it's...
Well, I don't think we're going to sort this out. I take Jennifer's point that I in particular should be very careful about what we claim on the air. And Jennifer, I appreciate your flagging it for us. Julia is calling us from Baltimore. Julia, welcome to the show.
Yes. Sounds like right up my alley, but I've never had the courage to go out and forage, except for blackberries or raspberries. My comment is, I think describing to someone what is edible, describing it to them without them actually seeing it is very dangerous, because there are so many plants that look alike, except for maybe a small variant, that just describing something to someone without them actually seeing the true edible and the poisonous one is not something that should be done, because you may say a little yellow flower, and someone's perception of a little yellow flower could be totally different than yours, you know. And okay, so I think just describing this over the radio is to me very dangerous.
Julia, I appreciate your point. Nick, how...
Julia, I would encourage you to come out to either one of my walks or Eric's walks. We're pretty knowledgeable, and we can certainly show you lookalike plants. It's a little bit difficult to show over the radio,
And I think that's Julia's point.
Yeah, it's very difficult. So, and as Sheila mentioned earlier, we have several meetups that you could come out and participate in. And we want you to learn positive identification.
So, Julia, that you're making a good point. I guess the larger point that I'd also like to explore, though, is, as we hear from Julia, and certainly my reaction, too, is a lot of people don't forage because they are worried about the safety of it. You both know a lot and are very comfortable, but, I mean, how much should people be cautious? How unsafe is it? How risky is it?
It can be extremely risky. Plants are bioaccumulators, and I always tell people to be careful where you're picking plants. Cattails are wonderful. There's so many parts of the cattail plant that you can eat. Cattails are aquatic plants, and they're especially prone to picking things up. Cattails are planted for mitigation of contamination sources. So when I pick cattail, I make sure that I'm picking it in a pristine area. That's one thing. Positive identification is another, and I'll show people look-alike plants. So positive identification of plants is key.
And also take it slow. There's been plenty of people that have had no problem. I won't mention the plant. It's a common plant that both of us, I think, brought in here, have had no problem eating it, and then one person, for whatever their constitution, wanted to reject that plant, it caused an allergy reaction for them. So you have to take it slow. And
when you say take it slow, you mean eat just a small quantity?
Small piece at a time and see if you have a reaction to it. And I think there's a rule or whatever that if it reacts in your mouth, then don't eat it, of course. But even that, like, you could have a reaction hours later, you know, which could be vomiting, explosive diarrhea, and all kinds of violent reactions.
That's an excellent point, Eric. I always tell people when they come out to try things sparingly the first time they try it, because they don't know what their system is like with something new. I've got an iron constitution. I can eat almost everything. Eric, I'm sure you can also. But I tell people, first time you try something, try it sparingly.
We're going to take another quick break here. Julia, again, thanks for the call. When we come back, more on learning how to identify wild growing things that are good and safe to eat. You can join our conversation by sending an email to midday@wypr.org or phoning us 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking this hour about foraging, the art of finding wild edibles. I'm speaking with biologist Nick Spiro, who teaches foraging courses through the Natural History Society of Maryland, and Eric Kelly, founder of Charm City Farms, where he leads foraging classes. We're taking your calls at 410-662-8780 and your emails at midday@wypr.org. Elizabeth wrote us sort of picking up on the point you were just making about where you forage. She said, please have your guests talk about the precautions needed for foraging next to roads and highways, specifically the toxicity of combustion products from vehicles and the possible use of sprays.
I can answer that in one word. Two, don't pick there. Three words. I would never pick along a highway. You need to be cognizant of contaminants, either road contaminants, pesticides, herbicides. Picking along the side of a road is not the way to go.
Okay, that addresses that. Another email from Alice. I love garlic mustard greens. They grow everywhere. Amazing sautéed in olive oil. You're both looking at me.
Yes.
Like.
It's an invasive plant. Eat them all.
Okay, let's talk about invasive. I would think that's true. I mean, are we mostly talking in foraging about plants that are so hardy that they grow even where they're not invited to grow?
Yes.
So are they? Do they tend to be what What we also call invasives. And is that something we should call them?
We're right away jumping into putting our human persuasion on the entire system we're looking at. So, I mean, whether we want them there or not is an individual agenda that I don't think we can, you know, determine for everybody. And I don't generally use the word invasive. I do sometimes, and native and non-native. But that's a whole different heated conversation.
Michaela is calling us from Towson. Michaela, welcome to Midday.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. You partially answered that question before about the safety of plants depending on where you pick them. And it's understood that you don't pick along highways, but how do you know whether an area is safe to pick a plant? If you go in a field, you might have pesticides on it. If you pick it somewhere in a forest, it might be a forest that's somewhere on a dump. So how do you tell whether it's safe to pick a plant?
Thanks for the question, Michaela.
That's an excellent point. You can walk in the middle of a forest and think you're in a pristine area, and it can be on top of a dump. So I can't answer that for you, Michaela. For me, I do research on where I'm foraging and make sure that I am in an area that's fairly clean.
What kind of research do you do?
I'll look at the history of that farm, that area, to see what it had been used for in the past. Farmer fields can be good depending on the time that you pick. If it's pre or post spraying, you need to be cognizant of that. The edge of fields can be a horrible place for overspray. So different times of the year, you want to pick at different places.
You're not making me feel more secure about foraging.
Look at Eric. Look at myself. We're both pretty healthy.
But you're both very knowledgeable.
Yes.
And it seems like, as I said a few minutes ago, getting from where I am to where you are would take a lot of time and effort, and I could make some pretty bad mistakes path.
I think it's up to you. I mean, you don't want to forage, don't forage.
Okay.
You know, I mean, we're not forcing anybody to do it. It's fun for us because we like to be outdoors anyway. So while we're there, we'll, you know, gather this or that. I feel like you can walk in the middle of the grocery store and not know you're standing on top of a dump. I mean, you don't know what's being brought in with the vegetables that we trust, you know?
How much of your own personal diet do you estimate is foraged food?
Depends on the time of year and how much help I'm getting, but probably between 10-15%.
Uh-huh. I
brought some stuff here that has been preserved for later, which I'm really hot about doing around this time of year because there's flushes of particular things that come up that's so abundant that you really couldn't keep up with eating it anyway. So I try to fill the larder.
And I recognize the larger of the jars. I think I recognize the things that almost look like slightly orange pickles looking at me through the glass are actually daylilies, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And they've been pickled or what?
They have been pickled.
But the jar next to it with the green, they look like very fine green beans.
Mm-hmm. This is a pickled greenbrier. And I think Nick brought in some fresh greenbrier, which is taste and texture-wise similar to a green bean, I think. I'm not usually fortunate enough to find really big patches of it unless it's in a really tick-infested area, which I stay away from anyway.
We had a caller earlier with a question. I think he couldn't stay with us. A question about, are ticks obviously you don't want to be near ticks yourself. Are they dangerous with food? I mean, do they get on the food?
Ticks are probably not dangerous on the food, but they could be dangerous while you're picking the wild edibles.
Right, because of Lyme disease.
Yeah, there's Lyme disease, there's Ehrlichiosis, there's Babesiosis. That's a whole new show. But be cognizant and take precautions when you go out to forage.
This greenbrier, which does look like the way I've seen green bean plants, kind of tendrils around it, but a very good taste. Gene has called us from Baltimore. Gene, welcome to Midday.
Hi, I've been on field walks with Nick and with Eric, and they were just so much fun, and people really enjoyed themselves. Nick, gave us some simple ways of tasting food, pressing it to our lips first, then chewing a tiny amount. And I wonder if he could explain that to your listeners, because it was really clear.
I can. But first, let me say that that is not a practice that I would ever use. It's common in several books. They tell you to take a plant and rub it on your skin. If there's no reaction, rub it on your lips. If there's no reaction, put a small amount in your mouth. If there's no reaction, chew it. This would be one plant at a time, not multiple plants, because you want to make sure you're assessing a plant. A better way to do that would to be positively sure what the plant is and know that it is edible. The only time I would use something like that, if I were in out of Slobovia and I didn't know what the particular flora was, I would have to try that.
So, I mean, you have a lot in your head already, but how do you research it? If you encounter a plant that you don't recognize and want to positively ID it, which you said multiple times, that's the first rule of foraging, positively ID. What do you do?
There are dichotomous keys to key plants out there, dichotomous keys for any organism.
What is a dichotomous key?
Dichotomous key, two, it gives you a choice. So you look at a characteristic, and if that characteristic is persistent or present, it'll tell you to go to the next step. If it's not, it'll tell you to go to 14A. 14A will take you to 20 or whatever, depending on characteristics. That's a whole other story.
So this is a resource, like a book that
Absolutely.
You have with you?
Absolutely. It's a resource that's online also, and it's very easy to use online.
I see. So you're not only looking at what you already know about the plants.
Certainly.
But you're going to a dichotomous key. Tyler called us from Annapolis. Tyler, welcome.
Yes, hello. Hi, Sheila. Thank you for taking my call. I just had a quick question about are there any in particular in our area in Baltimore, Annapolis, and anywhere in the woods, plants that are like particularly very poisonous, you know, things that we just definitely should not be eating that apart from, you know, explosive diarrhea and vomiting, it will cause more damage to us. And, you know, how do we look out for those? You know, what's and then another question would be sort of what's a trusted website to look on if we can't make it to one of your walks?
Tyler, I appreciate the call. Again, we have been warned about trying to describe very dangerous things on the radio, but can either of you answer Tyler's questions about whether there is?
I wouldn't. I'd say stay away from berries probably because people can confuse berries. There's plants, but again, your own constitution can dictate some of that. For instance, Victoria, who does a lot of our plant walks, is very sensitive to jack-in-the-pulpit tubers and pokeweed. I'm not almost at all. I do like a stir-fry with pokeweed, and I'm fine. She would probably be doubled over and in bed. So if you can't... I mean, it's back to just know what you're looking at. Yeah, I mean, if
Tyler, we're not giving you.
There are poisonous plants in Maryland that you would want to avoid. Amanita verrosa, the destroying angel, will not make you
destroying
sick.
Destroying angel sounds.
Yeah,
sounds,
it's a plant. It'll kill you. There's water hemlock. Potentially, that could kill a child. So there are plants that you need to be aware of. In addition to what Eric is saying about things that don't agree with your particular metabolism, there are poisonous plants. It would be impossible for us to convey that to you. There are multiple sites that you could look at, but come out with knowledgeable people. There are great field guides. These resources were not available when I was young. Yul Gibbons was the guru, and he has mostly line drawings. So some of the field guides have actual photographs, and they're wonderful to use.
Is there a field guide that you recommend?
Eric has one that I love, the bottom one.
For a field guide?
Well, field guide. It's a book on wild edibles. Sam Thayer has two books out there. They're wonderful.
We're passing things across the table, knocking things over. So I'm holding The Forager's Harvest, A Guide to Identifying, Harvesting, and Preparing Edible Wild Plants, and Nature's Garden. by Samuel Thayer.
Both of these books would be great for a novice. These were resources that weren't available when Eric and I both started. He goes a little bit in more in depth in how to use plants, and it's a wonderful resource.
Samuel Thayer, T-H-A-Y-E-R, is the author of both of these guides. Eric, you about to say something?
We have free movie. This is on topic. So we have free movie nights, and the bottom book there, he actually has a DVD for that we've showed a couple times, the movie or the DVD of that bottom book.
We're almost out of time, and we've got some other things to talk about. Adam, very quickly, can you ask your question? Adam from Baltimore. Adam, are you still with us? I guess we have lost Adam. Nick, you have, we've talked about your foraging walks. You've got a walk coming up tomorrow?
That's correct. Cromwell Valley Park, which is in Parkville, off of Cromwell Road at 6:30.
And what are you going to do on this walk?
Well, we're gonna take a walk along a stream and show at least 30 different wild edible plants, and should take several hours to do this walk. I'll have my 7-year-old grandson out there, and he is quite knowledgeable. So if I mess up, I'm sure he'll kick me. Now, come on out. It's $15, and this money goes to the Natural History Society of Maryland. We're a nonprofit organization, and this is how we pay our bills.
If you'll give us a link, we'll link to it on our website. So people,
great.
I presume people should sign up. Eric, you have a fundraising dinner this weekend.
Dining on the Wild Side. We'll be having rabbit sausage, marinated bamboo shoots, mushroom and feta with greens in a pita pocket, chaga tea, homemade ginger ale, and...
What is the point of this dinner?
So we're trying to raise money to put a water catchment system on the brick barn, a structure that is there that we have classes in that doesn't have municipal water hooked up to it. And I wanted to do a water catchment system instead of getting hooked into the municipal water as a demonstration, one, and a model, and to also relieve the storm drains of water that comes off of impervious surface. Of course, our roof. And roadways, and store that water and then filter it for the kitchen that is there, as well as use it for irrigation.
It sounds like it'll be an interesting group of people, I bet, there too. Thank you both. I'm really grateful to you for this hour. Eric Kelly, founder of Charm City Farms, an urban agriculture initiative in Baltimore, and founder of Foragers of Baltimore. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
And Nick Spiro, biologist and foraging expert. Thanks.
Thank you.
And this is not foraged food, but we also thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. If you're looking for a book to read while sitting by the pool, we've got recommendations for you. Or share your favorite summer read. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org and join us tomorrow. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon. Get out and forage.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at wypr.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.